Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I have the honor and great pleasure of welcoming you here to the Collège de France for the lecture by Professor Adam Patapoutian, or Patapoutian, I don't know what's better pronunciation, the winner of the Nobel Prize for Medicine, who will present us this evening his research, which has earned him this magnificent distinction. This conference, entitled How Do You Feel? The Molecules That Sense Touch, is organized in partnership with the University Paris Cité, and I would like to give a special welcome to its president, Mrs. Christine Clerici. We are very grateful for this collaboration, and I would also like to thank my colleague Hugues de Thé, who worked to ensure that this meeting with Professor Patapoutian could take place this evening. We have actually here the Collège de France achieved a considerable feat, since we have been able to welcome in 1 month three Nobel Prize winners in medicine and physiology here at the Collège for conferences or seminars in 1 single month. Sir Paul Nurse, Philippe Sharp, and today Adam Patapoutian. I'm delighted, dear Adam Patapoutian, that you have been able to free yourself and you have agreed to speak to us this evening, and I hand over to the Dean of the Faculty of Health of the University Paris Cité, Professor Xavier Jeune-Maître, who will introduce you.
Monsieur l'administrateur du Collège de France, Madame la Présidente de l'Université, chère Christine, Messieurs, Mesdames les professeurs du Collège de France, cher Hugues de Thé, tous les chercheurs, étudiants, directeurs d'unités qui sont là, c'est un vrai plaisir pour moi et je vais maintenant passer en anglais. Et comme j'ai passé en anglais, je vais me permettre de mettre ce petit chapeau que vous allez trouver ridicule, mais qui n'est pas si ridicule que ça, puisqu'il vient de m'être offert par Adam Patapoutian et qui correspond à une casquette. Après, I'm going to translate after that. Qui correspond à une casquette du prix Nobel 2021 avec une petite représentation ici. Du canal Piezo en tridimension et qui fait en sorte que je suis extrêmement fier de porter cette casquette et je pense que personne ne me la volera. I first would like to express my deep gratitude to the members of the Collège de France, and particularly Professor de Thé, and also the Director of the Internal Affairs, Mr. Reynald Bellet, for immediately responding to our proposal to organize this event between the Collège de France and Université Paris-Cité on the occasion of the visit of Professor Adam Patapoutian, whose Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine in 2021. I think that no other place than this magnificent amphitheater at the Collège de France could have been better to welcome our host. Professor Adam Patapoutian was born in Lebanon in 1967. And attended the American University of Beirut before he immigrated to the United States in 1986 and became a US citizen. He graduated from UCLA in 1990 and received his PhD at Caltech in the lab of Dr. Barbara Hold in 1996. After postdoctoral work with Dr. Lou Reichard at UCSF, he joined the Faculty of Script Research in 2000. Where he is currently professor in the Department of Neuroscience. He also held a position at the Genomics Institute of the Novartis Research Foundation from 2000 to 2014. Professor Adam Patapoutian is a molecular biologist specializing in sensory transduction. His research has led to the identification of novel ion channels. He will speak on that, I suppose, and receptors activated by temperature, mechanical force, increased cell volume. His laboratory has shown that these ion channels play crucial roles in sensing temperature, touch, proprioception, pain, and regulatory vascular tone. So a lot of different functions. Professor Adam Patapoutian was awarded the Young Investigator Award from the Society for Neuroscience in 2006. Was named as an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute in 2014. He's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a member of the National Academy of Science, a member of the American Academy of Art and Science. He has been a recipient and co-recipient of many different prizes, and the last prizes in terms of the two or three last years in also in conjunction with Professor David Julius, who has the 219 Rosenstiel Award for Distinguished Work in Basic Medical Research, the 2020 Cavill Prize in Neuroscience, in 2021 the BBVA Foundation Frontiers of Knowledge Award, and so the 2021 Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine. I am lucky sometime, and chance and research meant that I had the great privilege of crossing the scientific road of Professor Adam Patapoutian about 10 years ago in search of the mechanistic elucidation of particular mutation at a new mechanoreceptor, piezo-1, that my lab found responsible for a familial form of pseudohyperkalemia, in fact corresponding to an inherited DORS disorder of the red blood cell. Knowing the first pioneer studies of Professor Adam Patapoutian's lab on this channel, I contacted him thinking that he could be interested by this first human genetic variants of this channel piezo-1. I was not surprised by the quality of his answer and work of his lab, but by his enthusiasm and humble personality, the easiness of establishing a collaboration, the rapidity and the quality of the work done by his lab. Indeed, they found that this peculiar gain of function piezo-1 mutation gave rise to mechanically activated currents, explaining the increased permeability of cation in red blood cells of these patients, and more broadly, suggesting a new role for mechanotransduction on these cells for volume regulation. So despite having been illuminated, I would say, by this collaboration, my personal scientific career did not follow by far the same brilliant trajectory as Professor Adam Patapoutian. Nevertheless, a few weeks after my solicitation following his nomination for the Nobel Prize, he did accept to make the trip to France, make a stop in Paris, and deliver this conference for the first time in live after his Nobel Prize lecture, before going to Marseille, where he has been invited also by former fellows of his lab, Aziz Mokrish and Bertrand Coste. Dear Adam, it's a real honor and privilege for us, Université of Paris Cité, Collège de France, to having you tonight to speak about your discoveries, and especially the molecules that sense touch. Adam, thank you again. The floor is yours.
Merci, Xavier. C'est un grand plaisir de vous voir ici, en personne, à Paris. Mais maintenant, je veux continuer en anglais avant que m'embarrasser. So this is indeed a very special seminar for me. Just like you just heard, not only my first in-person visit to a university since the Nobel, but actually since exactly almost 2 years ago, before COVID. So the last 2 years, only given a few talks and virtually. So it's really is wonderful to see you all. In addition, I love Paris, so it's wonderful to be here. It's great to be invited by an old collaborator that I'll tell you in a second, started our journey from the human genetics connection to of our research. I also have my lovely wife here, which she's only seen me give a talk a few times in person, so this is special. Also have our friends visit with us, and it's Lisa's birthday, so happy birthday, Lisa. Okay, so our perception of reality is based on our senses, and in the last few decades, we learned quite a bit about how we smell, taste, how we see, but this touch and pain is much less known about it. And it's an unusual sense because it gathers information from all over the body and translates mechanical, thermal, and chemical, many modalities, into electrical signal that neurons can understand and transmit to the brain. More generally, most cells communicate through chemicals, whether that's a neurotransmitter such as dopamine or insulin hormone being secreted. So we have learned a lot about signal transduction of chemicals, but we know very little about how cells sense and respond to pressure. So I'm here to tell you that your sense of touch is truly amazing. Humans can sense very tiny indentations in the nanoscales, 500 times thinner than a human hair, is something you can sense on your skin, which is, again, quite amazing. In addition, we rely on affective touch for our emotional health. And for the related sense of proprioception, you can sense where your fingers and arms are in space without looking at them. And you use this sense to be able to do simple tasks, such as standing up and walking, or beautifully demonstrated a very complex task, such as playing a musical instrument without looking at your hands. And you can see here Yo-Yo Ma on the cello, and actually Ukrainian origin, Emmanuel Ax, looking at each other while playing their instruments. But I actually do not know of any other image that illustrates the power of touch more than this. So the story behind this is this young man has visited the White House, and he tells the President Obama that his friends tell him his hair looks like Barack's hair. And the president immediately bends over and says, "Touch it, dude." And so, of course, we're not just talking about sensing the texture of the hair, but this wonderful affective nature of touch. So we commonly say seeing is believing, but President Obama knows very well that touching is really believing as well. So the flip side of touch is pain. We think of pain as a negative valence. However, acute pain is absolutely essential for survival. There are actually people who don't sense pain at all, and this is very dangerous. Many of them die very young. However, chronic pain, simply defined as persistent pain when the stimulus is no longer around, is a major unmet medical need. So how do we sense all of this? Touch, proprioception, pain. There are these mechanosensory neurons in a group of peripheral nervous system called dorsal root ganglia. So these are group of neurons just dorsal to the spinal cord. There are about 60 of them in mammals, and they gather information from periphery and translate it to the spinal cord and the brain. And one of their characteristics is that they're very heterogeneous. So you have some specialized to sense touch, others temperature and pain, and others proprioception. So if you look at the periphery, the same specialization translates into where they go. For example, proprioceptive neurons that we'll talk more about wrap around muscle cells, and they sense how much they're stretched. In the skin, if you look at more closely, you can see there's very different structural anatomical endings. So some, for example, pain and temperature sensing, we call them free nerve endings. Others connect to cells such as Merkel cells. Other are Meissner corpuscles, very specialized ending that all together give you this cutaneous sense of touch sensation. In addition, we'll touch upon this later as well, there are some of these neurons that innervate internal organs. Some you're aware of, some you're not. For example, bladder or the aorta, etc. So the question that we were interested in at the molecular level first, how do you sense a gentle breeze or a cactus pricking your finger? So for decades, it was known that there are these specialized ion channels, which are very fast signaling molecules that open and close, let ions in. But instead of most ion channels that are activated by chemicals, these were postulated to be activated by physical forces themselves, such as pressure or temperature. And yet their identity remained unknown for quite a while. So about 25 years ago, work done by David Julius's lab, my lab, and many others, identified a group of TRP trip ion channels that are direct sensors of temperature. But just about 12 years ago still, the identity of these mechanically gated ion channels had remained unknown. So we're mainly going to focus on these today, but I wanted to show you just two slides on temperature-activated channels. So the first one that my lab identified is called TRPM8. It's cold and menthol-activated ion channel. And what you're looking up here is electrophysiology, and this is excised cell-attached recordings. What really is characteristic is that you're looking at single proteins being activated on and off. So each of these deflections is a single ion channel opening. And the reason we thought this was a cold activated ion channel is this: in this, during this 1 second of cooling from 30 to 18 degrees centigrade, you see the single deflections, but as it gets colder, you can see multiple channels opening at the same time. So this is very unusual for most channels, and this is a cold activated channel. In addition, we found that it's also activated by menthol, which is an active ingredient in mint leaves. And of course, this is used in a variety of what we call over-the-counter product. So next time you brush your teeth and feel that minty coolness, you remember it's because of tryptamine. And I'm not going to show you, but we've shown that we and many others that tryptamine is required for sensing cold in the animal, specifically in mice. Another ion channel that we identified is called TRPA1, and one of its characteristics was that it's activated by many spicy compounds that we have thrown at it. And the list here includes active ingredient methyl salicylate of wintergreen oil, which occurs in, in mouthwashes. At the same time, if you like sushi, wasabi, or mustard, any of these, that burning sensation in your mouth and nose is because of activation of TRPA1. Even raw garlic activates it. So this is all very interesting. And again, the burning sensation is caused by TRPA1. But these studies actually led to an understanding that this channel is sensing reactive chemicals. All of these are reactive in nature. And this research kind of led to work suggesting that TRPA1 is a general pain sensor, and blocking it might be useful for a variety of therapeutic reasons to block pain, for example. And this is a great illustration of how long it takes to translate basic science into potential medicines. We identified TRPA1 in 2002, and 20 years later, now there's a phase 2 trial on TRPA1 blockers in indications such as back pain and osteoarthritis. Okay, this was just a little taste of temperature, but as promised, most of the time I'm going to focus on mechanically activated ion channels. And I thought this slide would help to look at the history of when we knew these ion channels existed and at the molecular level when they were starting to be identified. So the first hint that a channel directly gated by pressure exists was done work by Jim Hudspeth and colleagues, where they were working on hearing, which is another mechanosensory system, and working on hair cells, they measured the time between stimulation by mechanical force and activation of the hair cell, and the difference in time was so small, they postulated it's too fast to be accounted for second messenger system, such as G-protein coupled receptor sensing it and transmitting that system, that signal to an ion channel. That's just too slow to account for this. So they said there must be an ion channel that is directly gated by force. So Fred Sachs and others a few years later showed that this type of stretch-activated currents can be recorded from a variety of cell types, not just hair cells, including muscle cells. Over the last few decades, there's been many such ion channels identified, including in bacteria, worm, flies. However, none of these translated to vertebrates. Either direct homologs did not exist, or the homologs were not playing the same kind of role in mechanosensory signaling. There was, from a French group, Lasdunsky and Eric Honoré, mammalian mechanically activated channels identified. So these were potassium channels. And for example, if you're interested in sense of touch, this could not account for it, because if you activate a potassium channel in a neuron, it will hyperpolarize a neuron instead of activating, so the opposite direction. So what we're looking for is a cationic channel that's activated by pressure. And it took another 10 years for my lab to identify the piezo ion channels. Before I get into it, I also want to give you a quick look back of why these mechanosensitive channels were so late in the game to be found compared to other transduction molecules. So the first one that was identified is for vision. It's rhodopsin. It's a G-protein coupled receptor. And as you can see from the dates, it was identified very early, even before molecular biology was used in laboratories. And the reason is this rhodopsin, if you look at the sensory cell, the rod outer segment, 50% of this area by weight is rhodopsin. So this actually enabled people to do biochemistry, directly identify the protein and sequence it. And then the work of Richard Axel and Linda Buck, as well as Charles Zucker and Reba, identified the olfactory and taste receptors because they knew that G-protein coupled receptors, a group of proteins identified that's homologous to rhodopsin, were involved in taste and smell. And so they use PCR homology to identify these. But when we talk about mechanosensation, we know that there are ion channels. And if you line up all ion channels sequences compared to each other, there's not much homology. So you can't easily identify them in that manner. So we knew that we had to do a functional screen to find these. And so my talk is in three, hopefully short segments. First of how we identified the piezo ion channels. And then I'll tell you a little bit about piezo 2 and the sense of touch and related senses. And finally, tell you how piezo 1, its sister molecule, is playing roles beyond the nervous system. So all of this work was enabled by a French connection, of course, Bertrand Coste, who was a postdoc in my lab and now runs his own lab in Marseille. And Bertrand came to my lab specifically to clone mechanically activated channel. And he took two very important decisions. One is to find a very, very simple assay for recording from these ion channels. And what he was doing is recording whole cell electrophysiologically from a cell, and while doing that, coming with a blunt glass probe and pushing on the cell. So this is a little video that will show you what it looks like in real life. So this is the recording electrode. It's pierced inside the cell. And this is a blunt pipette that's just gently tapping the cell. And if this cell expresses these mechanically activated channels, you would be able to record them because they would open. So the second important assumption was to see where to get it from. And so these sensory neurons, the DRGs that I talked to you about, are very difficult to work with, heterogeneous. So he realized that many of the mechanosensitive channels are yet not identified, not just in touch neurons, but many other systems. So he said, if we find it from any cell, we can go back to the animal and see where it's relevant. So he said, why don't we try to see if an easy to work with cell line that you can divide in a dish can be mechanosensitive. And indeed, after screening a few, he found that these Neuro2A cells are mechanosensitive. And then we did RNAi screen. So we would be able to make a list of candidates that could be ion channels. This would be proteins that would be have two or more transmembrane domains. And then we would knock them down one by one and see which one's required for this current. So this is one of my favorite slides because it looks so simple, but it took a whole year for Bertrand to produce this data. So what you're looking at is this screen. So this is the maximal mechanically activated current from Neuro2A cells. This is the control cell in blue. And then each of these bars is a single gene being knocked out and recorded again. So to get this kind of error bars for each, you had to record 2 or 3 days for each candidate. And so after 11 months of getting continuously negative data, he finally, when he knocked down the candidate number 72, he saw a massive downregulation of this current. He quickly, this was called unknown family 38 member A. He quickly renamed it piezo-1 from the Greek piezi, meaning pressure. So this is great. It means if you get rid of piezo-1, you don't see this mechanically activated current. But this is also a data that we got really excited when he got this, which is when he takes the full-length piezo-1 and transfected in naive cells, he can see massive mechanically activated currents. So this is, each of these lines is he's pushing one more micrometers, and you can see after touching the cell about here, each more micrometers of pushing gives larger and larger inward current. And this is the quantitation. So naive cells don't respond, while piezo-1 expressing cells have massive responses. Nanoamp current, so this is very large currents compared to endogenous currents that we see. PSO1 has a sister, and very similar, if you overexpress it, you get these massive mechanically activated currents. They're about 40% identical. The only difference between them that this inactivates a little bit faster, you can see, compared to PSO1. So what do piezos look like? They're giants. PSO1 is about 2,500 amino acids. It traverses the transmembrane domain 38 times. Each of these is a transmembrane domain. That's more than any other protein in your genome. On top of that, they actually come together as a trimer, making this massive million Dalton almost protein on the membrane. We have solved the structure of PSO1 using cryo-EM, and each protomer is labeled with a different color. And each of these helices is a transmembrane domain. So the three protomers only touch each other in the most C-terminal region, where the ion channel pore is. The rest is just extended into the plasma membrane, where presumably they sense membrane tension. So this was done work by Kei Satome in the lab, together with Andrew Ward. McKinnon and Bailong Zhao labs also solved this structure. One of the first things you will notice is that they form like a cup, which is very unusual for a membrane protein. And the next slide shows this better. So this is a simulation of how we think piezos sit on the plasma membrane. They're kind of sitting in this cup inserted downward. And the idea is that any membrane tension stretch on this plasma membrane will actually extend these arms and will cause gating or opening of the ion channel. Since an open ion channel structure doesn't yet exist, this is just a hypothesis. So the rest of the talk, we're going to switch from the identification and structure to in vivo function. And we have been fortunate to be able to use both mouse models as well as human genetics data, both loss of function and gain of function mutations, to understand the role that these ion channels play in vivo, both in normal physiology as well as disease. So we were very excited when we first saw that PSO2 is expressed in the dorsal root ganglia neurons that I introduced earlier as being where you sense touch, pain, proprioception. So this is an in situ hybridization, RNA scope in situ of PSO2 in brown. You can see it's expressed in about 50% of dorsal root ganglia neurons. And so this gave us the confidence to start making mutations in mice and see what are they really required for. And this is a very primitive behavioral experiment, but it's actually the first one we did to check if they sense touch. There were actually not too many behavioral assays to ask a mouse if it feels touch, so we had come up with this kind of a bit bizarre experiments to do. But this is what we creatively call tape on the back. And we put a tape on the back, and this is a wild-type mouse. You can see it doesn't like it. It's trying to scratch it up. And here's a PSO2 deficient animal, completely oblivious to the fact that there's a tape on its back. But this quantitation shows how profound the lack of touch sensation is in these animals. These are three different assays. We put tiny hairs on their paws, see at what force they raise their paw. Again, wild type in gray, mutant in pink. This is a cotton swab, again touching their foot, or the tape on the back. As you can see, in all cases, the response of the PSO2 deficient animals is almost complete. How about proprioception? I mentioned this already. I think that proprioception is your most important sense, but I'm willing to bet that many of you don't even know what it is. So proprioception is based on these sensory neurons that innervate your muscles and tendons. And although you don't get the information of the muscle stretch, what you get is your sense of what space you occupy. So if I close my eyes, I know exactly where my hand is and I can bring it and touch my nose, for example. That's because of proprioception. And if you're very talented and work hard, you can do things like this. However, it's important, I think, to note that the reason most of us don't realize we have this sense and how important it is simply because we can't turn it off. Unlike vision, where you can close your eyes and imagine what it would be like to be blind, we don't we can't do this with proprioception. So, is piezo-2 required for proprioception in mice? In this case, we have made mice that are mutant in piezo-2, mainly in the bottom part of the body. And one of the phenotypes of lack of proprioception is extreme uncoordination, as you can see this mouse exhibiting. I'm only showing the behaviors here, but I also wanted to remind you that for all of these cases, we have to make sure that everything is normal about this mouse, except the fact that mechanosensory transduction is affected. And we do that by experiments like this. This is from Katie Wilkinson's lab, our collaborator. This is single fiber recordings of these proprioceptors innervating muscle. So when she stretches these muscles in a wild type, you can see massive upregulation of neuronal activity. In the knockouts, vast majority of them don't show anything. Once in a while, we see a little bit because we think there's a remnant piezo-2 available. So this makes sense and explains the behavior. What was really interesting for us when my collaborator, Alex Chesler, and their colleagues identified humans that do not have piezo-2, and they showed that many of the phenotypes that we had described in mice phenocopy exactly in humans if they don't have piezo-2. And I will show you this video. This is a piezo-2 deficient individual. She is blindfolded to test for proprioception. She's harnessed so that she doesn't hurt herself and asked simply to walk in a straight line. So most of us would have a very easy time doing this. As you can see, she struggles very much doing this, again, sense telling us that her proprioception is strongly deficient. How about pain? We know both from the mouse and human experiments that acute pain is slightly affected, but mostly normal. But what we're really interested in this chronic pain phenotype called tactile allodynia. Complicated two words, it simply means when you feel pain in response to touch. So you experience this after sunburn or injury, just touching or wearing a shirt can be painful. We can induce this in animals by injecting inflammatory animals, such as capsaicin. But more importantly, these are phenotypes that folks suffering from neuropathic pain experience, condition that there are no good treatments for it, especially I'm sure you all know about the opioid epidemic. We certainly need better drugs for these patients. And so we wanted to test this given its relationship to touch. And as I mentioned, when you inject capsaicin in the paw of an animal, this is the active ingredient in chili peppers that causes inflammation. You can see in wild-type animals, its threshold to when it starts raising its paw dips immediately within 5 minutes. So this is called sensitization or tactile allodynia. As you can see, in the piezo-2 deficient animals, this does not happen at all. So suggesting that although acute pain is normal in piezo-2 deficient animals, tactile allodynia is not. And interestingly, I'm not going to show you, but we've done neuropathic pain models in these animals, and we see the same, make the same observation. You know, most pharmaceutical companies will look at this and say, yes, 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 but it never translates from mouse to human. Well, we can test this. So Alex's lab have done pretty much the same experiment on these wonderful people who volunteer themselves for a little bit of potentially pain to do this experiment. So here we pick two dots on the arm. One of them gets capsaicin, one doesn't. And we simply are going to ask them, when they're blindfolded, is A or B becomes painful to touch? So we do this, they do this on control patients as well as piezo-2 deficient individuals. And as you can see, in both cases, when you look at laser Doppler where capsaicin was injected, you see the inflammation because this is dependent on the immune system. This is not the sensing part. And then they ask a simple question, is it painful A or B? So in the controls, 100% of the time, of course, know which side is the painful one. For the piezo-2 deficient individuals, they say, I have no idea. I'm not sensing anything. So they say, for this assay to work, you have to guess. So they guess something, 50% of the time they get it right. So tactile allodynia is completely missing in people without piezo-2. So this gives us indication, not a proof, that blocking piezo-2 might be very beneficial for patients suffering from neuropathic pain. However, I should come out and say that I cannot imagine an oral systemic drug blocking piezo-2, because as I showed you, it would have severe on-target side effects, lack of touch and proprioception. But local application of antagonists could be very helpful, and we and others are working on this now. So I told you many of these sensations, touch, proprioception, pain, are kind of related to sensing outside the world. But the last few years, we've also gotten interested in sensing mechanosensation in our internal organs. And interestingly, in addition to dorsal root ganglia that innervate these organs, there's a whole other cranial peripheral nervous system called the nodos that innervate many of these organs, the lung, the heart, stomach, bladder, etc., and gather mechanical information and chemical information and send this information to the brain. Not only the molecules responsible for sensing these were not known, in many of these cases, the exact role of mechanotransduction in these systems are unknown. So I'm going to summarize a few years of work here just in one slide. Together with Chesler and Lieberless Labs, we've shown that piezo-2 actually is the sensor of lung stretch. And again, this is something you're not consciously aware of, but this sensing helps regulate each breath, how long is your breath, and also protects from overstretching of the lung. There's many ways to control blood pressure. One of them is a neuronal mechanism called baroreception, where these sensory nerves innervate the aortic arch, and from how much pressure they sense there, like a thermostat, regulate to keep your blood pressure constant. We showed that piezo-1 and 2 together, if you knock them out, baroreceptor function is completely ablated. And this is a sense that you are very aware of. If your bladder is stretched, you feel like you have to go to the restroom, and this apparently is also piezo-2 dependent. And again, we know this not just from the mouse studies, but the humans who are deficient in piezo-2 do not sense their bladder filling, and they have, during their childhood, got into the habit of going to the restroom 2-3 times a day to avoid accidents. But I also wanted to give you the impression that this is not a field that's completely figured out. For example, when you eat a big meal, which we've been doing a lot lately here in Paris, you feel full. As the name suggests, it's a very mechanical sense. And yet, if you look at the literature of satiety, about 99% of the papers focus on nutrient sensing, which is, of course, very important. However, how much does this stomach stretch contribute to how much you eat, when you stop eating, and later on to diabetes and obesity is really not known. And this is the kind of power of finding these molecules and having the human and mouse genetics. This is a subject that we are actively studying right now to see how much mechanosensation contributes to the sense of fullness. So till now, we focused on sensory neurons. But many cells in your body sense, experience, and respond to stretch. So blood vessel endothelial cells experience shear stress, muscles get stretched, many cells get indented, including sensory neurons, but as I'll talk about, red blood cells, for example. And piezo-1 appears to be expressed more widely than piezo-2. And over the years, my lab and many others have found some fascinating roles for piezo-1. So for example, we and others have shown that piezo-1 is absolutely required for proper development of blood and lymphatic vessels. Others have shown that your bone density regulation is dependent on piezo-1. And this is very interesting because people had known for decades that astronauts, for example, who go into outer space always come down with reduced bone density. Professional tennis players have higher bone density in their arm that they play with compared to the other. So this idea of pressure or mechanical force and bone density was known. Apparently, piezo-1 plays an important role in this. Very recently, we showed that with the Meta PATEX lab, Piezo-1 in the skin is involved in keratinocyte wound healing. But the rest of the talk, I want to tell you a little bit about piezo and its role in red and white blood cells. So red blood cells, I'd never thought about this before, experience massive mechanical force as they squeeze through capillaries half their diameter. And for piezo-1, so the first connection we had with a clinical study came from an email by my host, Dr. Jean Maître, and they had found this condition called hereditary xerocytosis in humans, which causes dehydrated red blood cells. And they called us and said, you know, there's a mutation in piezo-1 that does this. We were very happy to collaborate with them and showed actually electrophysiologically that all the mutations in piezo-1 that cause this are gain of function, which means given amount of force, you get more signal than the wild type protein. So this led to many other studies figuring out that piezo-1 actually regulates red blood cell volume, because when we knocked out piezo-1 in red blood cells, they were overhydrated. So the theory right now is that as red blood cells get squeezed through capillaries, instead of just passively shrinking, there's a piezo-1 dependent signaling that makes them in less volume to be able to passage through these very thin capillaries. So what are the consequences when things go wrong with piezo? And I won't have time to tell you, but inspired by the literature on sickle cell disease, which is a deformation of red blood cells that causes also protection against malaria, we looked at this, and at least in the mouse, gain of function piezo-1 does protect against malaria to a certain extent in mice. I'm not going to talk about it, but I mentioned it because this led us to a question, because xerocytosis was known to be a very rare, mainly in Caucasian, syndrome. So there's, I think, only about 120 people diagnosed worldwide, very, very rare, and none in, for example, African population. And we asked the question that if our mouse studies reflected what's happening also in humans, then you would expect gain-of-function mutations present in regions that are endemic with malaria. And we did a bioinformatics search to find if such an allele exists, and we found a fascinating one. So this is a, we found a mutation, it's actually single deletion of one amino acid in humans that electrophysiologically causes gain-of-function phenotype. And when you look at the distribution of this allele worldwide, you could see that the wild-type allele in this light blue color is dominant in, for example, European countries. But this mutation that we identified is quite common in people of African descent. Actually, almost anywhere we look in within Africa, including in African Americans, it's quite common. One in three people of African descent has this allele, which, you know, if you do a back of the envelope calculation, there are presumably 400 million people worldwide that have this allele, and even a pretty large number that have two copies are homozygous for this allele. This is a very subtle gain of function mutation, so by itself it doesn't cause disease. Obviously, with these numbers, that makes sense. But we thought this would be very useful tool to look at tendencies of different phenotypes in a large population of humans that are really understudied in the clinical setting. So our kind of path in the next few years, and I'll give you one example of this, is to start with this very rare condition, HX, hereditary xerocytosis. We have mouse models, so we can easily go and mechanistically try to understand how a disease or a biological process is affected. And then we can also look at a very large population in the clinic to see if there are tendencies of the phenotypes that we see here. So the example I'm going to tell you that was recently published is iron overload. So what is iron overload? Again, it's a very thought to be rare disorder affecting about 0.5% of Caucasians. The consequences are actually not very well studied, but excessive iron, especially in older age, can cause organ damage. The treatments are not very sophisticated, chelation therapy and phlebotomy. And interestingly, there was this one paper that said that age-dependent iron overload happens in these rare HX patients. So this is data from that paper. These are all HX patients, and we're charting their age on the x-axis versus a clinically relevant diagnostic tool for iron. And this red line is below it, it's considered normal numbers. You can see there's an increase overall by age. And most importantly, if you look at over 40 years, all the readings are actually above normal level. So we can say that HX patients experience age onset iron overload. So we looked at this in the mouse, and we saw something very similar. So in wild type adult heterozygous or even homozygous, there's no increased iron level. These are young adults, so it would be, you know, the same as what we were observed in the humans. But when we look at one-year-old old mice, you can see that in wild type, the levels stay okay, but in heterozygotes, we see higher levels, and homozygotes, really high levels. So this kind of confirms that our mouse model recapitulates what is observed in humans. But one of the great advantages we have in the mouse model is that we can express this gain-of-function allele only in the cell type that we want to express it. And our first guess was that this would be because of expression in red blood cells, but other cell types required for modulating iron levels are macrophages and hepatocytes, and we got a very surprising result. When we express the gain-of-function in older mice, their iron levels, you can see if it's red blood cell specific, we see absolutely no difference. But when it's in macrophages, we see the same effect that we see in the whole animals. Surprisingly saying that too much PSO1 activity in macrophages causes iron overload. So why is this? Shang Wei in the lab did lots of mechanical studies. I don't want to go through the details. All I want to show you is a video. First, I should say that gain-of-function PSO1, he showed that increases phagocytosis, which increases red blood cell turnover. And of course, red blood cells have lots of iron, so that's why this is happening. But then you would ask, why would increased phagocytosis, which is macrophages eating up red blood cells, would be increased if you have too much mechanotransduction? Does that make any sense? This is just a video that I got from YouTube, and you'll see the video of a macrophage eating up red blood cells. And just looking at this, you can see how I think mechanosensation might be very important. These tentacles extending, feeling the red blood cells. So there's lots of mechanistic studies to be done here, but we think we're on the right track of understanding whole new biology, how potentially macrophages use mechanotransduction to regulate one of their major functions, which is phagocytosis. So I told you about this direction, how we went from phenomenology to mechanistically understanding that this iron overload is being caused by increased macrophage phagocytosis. How about this large population of very subtle mutation? Are they affected and has been completely ignored? And indeed, that seems to be the case. So Shang Ma did this little study with human samples. So he received from 333 individuals that are just self-identified as African-American. And this is from a commercial blood collection center. And he genotyped for this PSO1 locus. As expected, 1 in 3 were positive for the gain of function. And then he measured, just like I showed you before, these transferrin and ferritin levels, which are clinical indicators of iron levels. So I'll just show you the results in this slide. This is simply the genotyping. So out of these 333 individuals, there were 101 that were heterozygous, just like we predicted, and 8 homozygous. And then we ask, what's the distribution if we look at the ones that have relatively high iron levels? And you can see for transferrin and ferritin, this light green color part of the pie chart really extends. So they're overrepresented, including the homozygous. Interestingly, if you take a clinical diagnosis of combination of high transferrin saturation and ferritin, you can see all 10 individuals that made this cutoff all have either 1 or 2 copies of the PSO1 gain of function. It's a small sample, but this is impressive numbers. E756 deletion are 12 times more likely to have high ferritin levels than non-carriers. Of course, we realize that much larger studies are required, but we're excited that this could tell us something about novel biology and clinical implication. So I showed you in this last part that E756 delete is associated with high serum iron levels in African Americans. So this is pretty mind-boggling, I think, that a large population has a greater risk of developing iron overload-related problems, and this was completely ignored. And if nothing else, this could be useful as a genetic diagnostics to identify who will potentially suffer from late onset symptoms from iron overload. Most importantly, we found, I think, a novel biology of mechanotransduction in macrophages, and Shang Ma, who's going to start his own lab soon, wants to follow up and see what other consequences are there in overactive macrophages in piezo-1 gain-of-function animals as well as clinical data. So very similar, coming back to the sickle cell story, it seems to us that gain-of-function piezo-1 might have advantages, for example, protection against malaria, but we also think it might have disadvantages, and one of them is increased iron levels. But with the more of these wonderful databases like UK Biobank and NIH's All of Us that do these 500,000 people genotype-phenotype association, we're hoping that this kind of genetic genomic studies will help us figure out more roles of mechanotransduction and potential clinical implications. As the last two slides, I want to get away from vertebrates and tell you that piezo-1s are present across different phyla. So we were mainly focused on this branch, but flies, C. elegans, single cellular organisms, as well as plant kingdom have piezos. And we're just starting to look into some of these other species, and flies already we've looked at. But recently, we looked at piezo in plants. And plants, mechanotransduction is important for them as well. For example, a plant root, when it encounters a harder surface, it has to make a decision whether it has to go right through or go around it. This is, of course, mechanotransduction. Interestingly, Alireza Mousavi found that plant piezo is expressed in the root tips, right at the place where this kind of monitoring the surface tension of its soil is located. And indeed, he showed that if plant Arabidopsis plants don't have piezo-1, they have a harder time penetrating through harder surfaces. So I find it really fascinating that through evolution, the same group of molecules that help you sense touch are also used in the plant roots to navigate its soil environment. So to conclude, we have found that piezo-2 is the principal mechanosensor for touch, proprioception, and the related internal organ interoceptive function. Piezo-1 has taken us into a new realm of mechanotransduction that we weren't thinking about in non-neuronal cells, as I illustrated with the story in macrophages. And we are very excited that this studying both the human and mouse genetics is giving us a foothold to, again, in the future, find novel areas where mechanosensation is important for physiology and disease. And finally, there are more sensors to be found. I already mentioned that in the piezo-2 deficient animals as well as humans, acute pain is relatively normal. So we can record from these channels that exist in DRGs that are required for acute pain, and yet we do not know their identity. So we have been looking for these for 10 years. We haven't found them yet, but we're going to keep looking. So these are the names of all the people, current lab members, alumni, as well as worldwide collaborators, including Xavier, and all the funding that's so important for biomedical research. I can't name them all, but I thank them very much. But instead of ending with a slide full of names, just have two more slides. One, this is a lab reunion from my lab. I consider myself so privileged to come in every day to the lab and work with these young, enthusiastic scientists to uncover how our body works. And so I consider myself, as I said, very privileged. And I also like to remind them and remind you trainees who are here is what a great pleasure it is to do this kind of discovery research. And often we forget why we got into science, for the beauty, for the discovery, and we let frustrations such as a paper not being accepted or funding not going through to consider ourselves miserable. But it's important to remember why you got into science in the first place. It's fun and it's wonderful. I also wanted to show this slide, which I like. One of the things I loved about science is how it's an international process, and usually immigration is embraced. So this is a map of each pin is someone in my lab was born and did their PhD or postdoc in my lab. As you can see, we have pretty good representation. We can do better in the Southern Hemisphere, but we're working on it. I should also mention that only a third of these are women, the rest are male, so we're working on that as well. But this is me. I was of Armenian descent, born in Lebanon. And when I came to US when I was 18 years old, I didn't even know that science as a career was a possibility. So I'm very fortunate to have found this calling that I love so much. But you can see that it's an inspiration to me to interact with all these people from all over the world to do the science that we do. And I think this is simply at a micro scale. Of course, if we look in the last 2 years about the cooperation of science across the world for dealing with COVID, from the sequencing to finding the vaccines and the drugs to help keep the load down, have all been incredible international collaborations. And I hope, like me, you are very proud, and hopefully society understands the importance of dedication and investing in research, which starts that whole process. Anyway, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure to be here with you.